says weather.
First, Sir Rudolf Piles, who was part of the team that made the atom bomb. The presenter is Sally Hardcastle.
Birmingham, 1940. The bombs are falling, the fires spreading. Equipped with a helmet and an axe, a small man wearing owlish spectacles helps to extinguish the flames. During the Second World War, Rudolf Piles fought fires by night and was professor of theoretical physics at Birmingham University by day. It's unlikely that those who worked alongside this 33-year-old amongst the charred remnants of Birmingham streets realized that he was one of the brightest of a brilliant generation of scientists, most of them German Jews who'd sought refuge in Britain. But for Rudolf Piles, it was not enough to use his brain for his adopted country. He had to risk his life as well.
You could see on the horizon fires burning and bombs coming down and anti-aircraft guns, shells going up. And you said to yourself, that's where we're going. That was a bit uncomfortable. But in fact, once you got there, you saw that there was still a lot of space between the bombs.
What was the attitude actually of some of the other men to you? Did they know you were a theoretical physicist?
That seemed to them very strange, and they teased me a bit. In fact, they always called me the professor.
You did at one time, instead of leaving Britain shortly before the war, didn't you, and going to America?
The thought was there only for a short time, because in 39, when the situation in Europe became difficult, and there was a possibility that we might get more appeasement, then I just wrote to friends in America that if that is so, if there is appeasement, then I'm ready to accept any job, whatever kind, in America.
Why was that? Why did you feel?
Because I felt Europe would be too depressing, that sooner or later this country would be affected. But I said, on the other hand, if it does come to war, then I want to stay and do my part.
But it was the part he played by day that changed the course of the Second World War. In 1939, the discovery of nuclear fission had led to speculation among physicists that a chain reaction in uranium could build into a bomb. It was found that this was not possible in ordinary uranium. But one day in the spring of 1940, Rudolf Piles was discussing this problem with Otto Frisch, a fellow German Jew and eminent physicist. Frisch asked the question, what if a rare isotope of uranium is used? They worked out the answer. Not only would the critical size of the isotope necessary be extremely small, but the explosion at the end of the chain reaction would be extremely large. They had invented an atomic bomb. Both men feared that if they could make the calculation, so could a scientist devoted to Hitler.
The idea of Hitler getting this bomb first was certainly frightening. That was the main thing that made us step on it and persuade other people to take it seriously. I think we probably, even if it hadn't been for that danger, we probably would have gone ahead anyway, because here was a new weapon which could make all the difference to the chance of winning the war.
Birmingham University was a centre of scientific invention during wartime. Radar was being perfected there, although ironically Professor Piles was not allowed to participate in work on it because he'd once been an enemy alien. Even in 1940, when he was a naturalised British citizen, he had to move out of his office because it was in the building where the cyclotron was shrouded in secrecy. Yet, after a few moments of conversation, he and his friend Frisch were the keepers of an even more monumental secret.
We met quite often, and sometime we talked in the university common room. Also at that time, Frisch was staying in our house, so sometimes we talked in the evening at home. And where exactly what parts of the discussion took place, I cannot remember.
Because there's the story that you worked it all out on the back of an envelope.
Well, that's more or less, yes. I don't know whether it was actually an envelope, but I mean, some odd scraps of paper were quite enough to work out what we did.
It wasn't a secret they could keep to themselves, so they typed out a memorandum which now seems extraordinarily far-sighted. It not only summarised their calculations, but predicted absolutely accurately the effects of the resultant bomb. The memorandum was passed on to a committee which had been trying and failing to work out how to cause an explosion from the nuclear chain reaction. Once the memorandum was assessed, a new committee was formed, and the inexorable process leading to the manufacture of a bomb started. Margaret Gowing has written a three-part history of Britain and atomic energy. In it, she stresses the importance of that memorandum.
It is a document which has been immensely important in all our lives. Without the Frisch Paz Memorandum, it's probable that World War II would have ended before an atomic bomb was dropped. Everybody, of course, is entitled to his or her view whether this would be better or worse. For a whole variety of reasons, I think on balance it would have been worse. And I think indeed more lives would have been lost if in fact the bombs had not been dropped on Japan in 1945.
But in the memorandum, Piles and Frisch made clear that the main use they saw for the bomb was as a threat of mass destruction. Rudolf Piles recalls the day the document was produced.
I do remember how we wrote our memorandum. I had an office then in one of the physics buildings, which was on the ground floor, facing south. And it was a summer day or spring day. We had the window open as we were discussing the text of what we were writing. I think Frisch was actually typing it. Suddenly a head appeared in the window. But this was not a German spy, but it was one of the technicians who was growing some tomatoes on the south-facing wall outside our room, and who had been going along there, bent down, looking at his tomatoes, and then straightened up. Yeah.
Were you aware of the weapon, the power of the weapon, the threat of the weapon?
Oh, yes. We discussed the effects of the weapon, and that in most uses, lots of civilians would be hurt, and also that the radioactivity would be rather widespread by fallout and so on. And we then said, and therefore it might never be a weapon suitable for use by this country.
You really thought?
We said that. But we said the main purpose of having it was as a deterrent against other people having such a weapon, and that there might be occasions when its use made sense, for example, against the naval concentration of naval ships, it would be fair to use it.
Did you ever think, this is awful, this is a horrible weapon, I'll tear up these scraps of paper and perhaps no one else will find out about it?
No, that never occurred to us, because it would be quite unreasonable to assume that nobody else would find out. I mean, you cannot undiscover things once they are known. And in fact, we thought maybe the Germans were already ahead of us, although it turns out they weren't. Sitting on an idea by not telling other people doesn't make sense.
But have you ever regretted that you were the one who actually did it?
No, I think we had really no choice. And of course, we did not foresee that this would lead to the present absolutely crazy arms race.
That memorandum altered the course of the history of the Second World War and of modern warfare. Then Professor Piles took a decision which, unknown to him, also changed the course of history. To the team working on the bomb, he recruited another German refugee, Klaus Fuchs. Fuchs had been a member of a left-wing student group in Germany, came to Britain to escape the Nazis, and at the beginning of the war was interned as an enemy alien. He was sent with internees to Canada, where, because he was not Jewish, he was separated from other refugees and put in a camp with the Nazis he deeply hated. When he was released and returned to Britain, Piles decided that such a staunch anti-Nazi would be a good member of the team. Fuchs not only worked with the professor, but also became a lodger at the Piles home. Neither Rudolf Piles nor his Russian wife, Jenya, could have known that their young lodger was a communist and was passing the secret of the bomb to the Soviet Union.
I knew Fuchs slightly, and I knew that he had returned to Edinburgh after being interned and sent to Canada. And it struck me that that might be somebody who would be useful. And indeed he was.
Now, of course, your family got quite close to him. What kind of a man was he?
Rather quiet and not actually silent, because when you asked him a question, he would answer quite articulately. My wife called him Penny in the Slot, because you had to put in something in order to get an answer out. Of course, he didn't display his political views while he was with us, And he never said much about this, but he managed to get the impression that his views were similar to ours, though perhaps somewhat to the left.
So, I mean, you would never have suspected that he...
Wouldn't you? No.
Eventually, the whole team, including Fuchs, who was under no suspicion at that time, decamped to America, and eventually to Los Alamos in the New Mexican desert. There, led by Robert Oppenheimer, they concentrated on the construction of a bomb. There was time off for fun, but minimal contact with outsiders. Then came the day of the first nuclear bomb test. They saw the flash, the fireball, and the very first of the now terribly familiar mushroom-shaped clouds. So they knew it worked, and then it was dropped by the Americans on Hiroshima.
It was, of course, exhilarating to feel that this meant the war was over and that our work had contributed to that. But, of course, also horror at the suffering caused. Although one has to remember that the number of people, the number of casualties in Hiroshima was not more than in any of the big fire raids on Tokyo or Dresden. We were rather shocked when the second bomb was dropped within a few days of the first one, though we didn't, of course, know enough about the strategic situation to have a view at that time. But of course, looking back, one thinks that the second one certainly was not necessary.
In fact, do you think either of them were necessary? Might there have been enough way of using the bomb?
To drop it first on some not densely inhabited area, you would have to kill some people and destroy some buildings, because without that, people wouldn't see the power of this new weapon and wouldn't have the effect.
Now, you had, of course, been worried about Germany getting hold of the bomb. Did it ever worry you, because you knew the Soviet Union, you've been there before the war, did you worry about the consequences of the Soviet Union getting hold of the bomb?
We didn't think about that at the time because, first of all, the Soviet Union at that time were our allies, but also we knew that they were invaded by Germany and struggling in very difficult circumstances. They would not have been able to start an enormous technological project of that kind. They didn't, in fact, do it until after the war.
How, in fact, then, did you react when you found out that Klaus Fuchs had been passing on information on the bomb?
Well, that was a tremendous shock. It comes as a great shock when somebody whom you regard as your friend and whom you think you know has this kind of secret hidden. Of course, it took a long time before we really believed that this is what happened. It was a time when we hadn't. After his arrest, the details were not published, and we thought maybe we did know that the thing was based mainly on his confession, and so we thought perhaps he had some kind of mental breakdown and was exaggerating some episode of something like that. And it took some time before we accepted that this was all.
Did you come to understand, perhaps, why he did it? What, because of his background, because of his history?
Well, he certainly, later appeared that he had been a communist and member of the party in Germany. And that was understandable because the communists were the only people who were fighting the Nazis. Apparently he swallowed all their theories and their orthodoxy. In fact, I visited him in prison after his arrest because the newspaper reports of his first hearings said that he didn't know where to find a lawyer. And I decided whatever happened, he must have a lawyer to defend him. So I went to see him. Then I said I was surprised that he had accepted all this orthodox Marxist view. And he said, well, you must remember what I went through as a young man in Germany. But also, he added, it was almost my intention that When I had helped the Russians to take over the whole world, I would get up and tell them what was wrong with their system.
Well, how did you react to that?
Yeah, it seemed enormously, well, both arrogant and naive.
Rudolf Piles, now Sir Rudolf, he was knighted in 1968, is not the kind of man to regret his actions. He says there's no point. All you can do is observe the outcome of those actions and then look for practical ways of dealing with the outcome. In retrospect, he believes he and other scientists place too much confidence in the common sense of governments, that they might behave less than reasonably when handed this gigantic new source of power did not really occur to physicists, even though they knew so well the damage the power could wreak. Sir Rudolf can sound cool and calculating while talking about the death and destruction caused by an atom bomb, but Margaret Gowing claims that is simply the practical scientist speaking.
I don't think he's cold at all. I think that he thinks coolly about many problems because he can think very rationally about them. And I think his whole attitude to arms control, for example, about which he feels very strongly indeed, but it is expressed in extremely cool language, which I think increases its importance as an expression of view, rather than if he in fact wrote strongly and rather emotionally about it.
Does he feel emotionally about it, though?
I think, of course, he feels very, very strongly about the madness of it. And I think that he has explained what is the most effective way of any of the arms control people, why the whole search for a balance of nuclear weapons is so absurd.
Sir Rudolf is a director of FREEZE, an organisation dedicated to halting the production of new nuclear weapons. He believes that only through agreement on all sides to stop building more and better bombs can governments move on to the next stage of working out what is really needed from their current arsenal. He doesn't see that, as one of the parents of the atomic bomb, he's being slightly inconsistent in trying to prevent others making the next generation of weaponry.
I don't think that's inconsistent at all, because there is no need for the enormous number of sophisticated weapons everybody has now. I think everybody is agreed that you cannot win a nuclear war, you can only lose. And so the only purpose to have nuclear weapons now is as a deterrent against nuclear attack by somebody else. Now, for that purpose, all you have to have is enough weapons to inflict unacceptable damage on the other side. You can argue what is unacceptable damage and how many weapons do you need for that. But there's no question that what you need is enormously less than the present ridiculous